The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we still,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Lee Phillips is a science writer and EU affairs journalist. His writing has appeared in Nature, The Guardian, Scientific American, and The Daily Telegraph. His book, Austerity Ecology and the Collapse Porn Addicts, is coming from Zero Books in October. According to Phillips, modernity is not the cause of climate change and the wider biocrisis. It is indeed capitalism that is the source of our environmental woes, but capitalism as a mode of production, not the fuzzy understanding of capitalism from the likes of Naomi Klein, Bill McKibben, Derek Jensen, Paul Kingsnorth, and their anarcho-liberal epigones as a sort of globalist corporate malfeasance. It's Wednesday, the 2nd of September, 2015, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. In this episode, you'll hear from Derek Jensen, the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, and Stephen Fry reading from Douglas Adams' Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. We'll also flip up and down the dial on mainstream ecological paranoia and hear a clip from Negative Land. The music you're listening to right now is the Grateful Dead's instrumental hit, Cold Rain and Snow. But in just a moment, you'll hear Lee Phillips defending modernity. Lee Phillips is a science writer and EU affairs journalist. His writing has appeared in Nature, The Guardian, Scientific American, The EU Observer, and The Daily Telegraph. His book, Austerity, Ecology, and the Collapse Porn Addicts, is due out from Zero Books in October. Lee, welcome to Zero Squared.
Hi there.
So let me ask you something off the cuff here, a personal question. Mm-hmm. And don't get offended, but have you ever smoked pot?
Yes.
Okay. Well, because I've known people, maybe I'm not going to say, but I've known people. Let's say I've known people who smoke pot.
Yeah.
And I wanted to tell you about one of them. He made a film. It was 20 years ago. He made a film, which was an advertisement, like a mock advertisement. For a mall that would be opening up, but it would be taking over everything in your city, like all of the space. And the slogan was, Mall of America or something, better than nature. Why worry about grass and trees when you can replace it all with man-made technology? So I wanted to ask you: Are you fighting for the mall?
It's a false dichotomy to be suggesting that one has to choose the one over the other. In fact, if anything, in order to live up to a lot of environmentalist ideals in terms of the aesthetics that humans appreciate in nature, in order to do a better job of conservation, for example, in order to deal with the genuine issues of climate change and the wider biocrisis, there's a series of modernist technologies and very progressive ways of organizing society and our economy that should be embraced. In order to do exactly what we want to do in terms of environmental protection, the idea that we can retreat back to some sort of pre-capitalist, smallest, beautiful, localist Arcadia not only is a sort of reactionary, unwanted prospect in terms of human flourishing, it actually doesn't, it's not even going to work in terms of environmental protection. Certainly, it is probably one of the worst options out there if we are trying to prevent catastrophic climate change.
That part of your book and that part of your argument is the most significant part. The fact that not only, you know, you make a lot of different arguments in your book, and not only is it wrongheaded to make this split between man and nature, not only is it backwards looking, not only is it sometimes classist, but worst of all, it won't work, right?
Absolutely.
But let's start with where you start at the beginning of your book, and with some of the symptoms of this austerity ecology, or the collapse porn addicts. You talk about a piece you did for Nature magazine. You were covering some bombings that occurred, terrorist bombings perpetrated by the individualities tending towards the wild.
It was kind of a strange series of events. There had been a kneecapping of an Italian researcher who worked with Finmeccanica, which is a sort of Italian conglomerate that they do a lot of different things. And this researcher had been kneecapped, that is like shot in the knee, by a group of Italian eco-anarchists. And this group was sort of loosely connected to a series of other eco-anarchist groups that were also responsible for an attempted bombing of a Swiss nanotechnology laboratory. The claim that they, sorry, the reason that they, in their communique, why they targeted this this Italian researcher was because Finmeccanica was supposed to be, you know, the wizard of, you know, of science, and science was death, and their association with nanotechnology in particular, but also nuclear power. And I wrote up that story for Nature as a sort of news article after having spoken to a number of sort of Europol and Swiss and Italian security services and police and so on and so forth to try to fit together sort of picture of what was happening here. But one of the reasons that I was pushed in that direction out of interest was that I'm a progressive. This is not foreign to me, these groups. I'm familiar with the kind of people who would do this. It's never been my particular political philosophy. I'm a socialist, not an anarchist or eco-anarchist or anything like that. But you're from Portland. You're familiar with this sort of scene.
You knew how to talk to them anyway. You might give them
absolutely. I thought I could sort of have a, hey guys, I'm like, you know, I'm progressive too, but this is crazy. But also more like there were a much more extensive series of bombings and attempted bombings in Mexico by a group with a very similar sort of, if not even more radical, anti-civilization eco-anarchist perspective. And it would be too strong to say that this is this worldwide network of anti-civilization activists or eco-anarchists, but they certainly are aware of each other and, you know, salute each other's bombings in different communiques that they put out and on websites and so on and so forth. And Nature was very, very interested in this story. And so I went to Mexico and I spent a few weeks there trying to track these people down, but also to speak to the researchers themselves. And to get their perspective, and it turned into an interesting feature for Nature.
Yeah. All this is reminding me of the Unabomber.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. The communique, many of the communiques from ITS referenced some of the work or the writings of the Unabomber. It's a little bit more, I suppose it's more updated from that era, but they're very much in line with that sort of thinking. Updated in the sense that overlaid with concerns about climate change, the wider bio crisis, Our understanding of these issues has developed since the, I guess, the late 80s, early 90s, that the Unabomber was active.
Yeah, well, I think it was the mid-90s where he kind of got caught and released his... It might be like 94 or something like that. Around the same time, I don't know, maybe it's a little earlier, but I think it was around the mid-90s. But yes, the thing is, I recall, this is a confession, I recall being the kind of person that was had a mixed feeling about the Unabomber at the time. You know, I was living in Portland. I was reading Green Anarchy magazine and Anarchy magazine. Right. I consider myself an anarchist. And I thought, well, he was going after people who were, you know, the technicians of capitalism. And so maybe it was justified to try to shut that down. But then I thought, but this guy has no class analysis at all.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I couldn't really support him, but I thought, but the tactic was, see, the interesting thing, the problem with going after people like the Unabomber or these individuals who tend towards the wild, for bombing is that, you end up with a critique of violence, which they're really used to dealing with, right? Mm-hmm. But you're going after them completely differently.
I know. I'm going. Obviously, the bombing is. I find it obvious that the bombings are horrific.
Right.
But much more important is the ideas behind it, and that's where it would be very easy to mount a critique of ITS or the Unabomber. These are utterly fringe groups. The problem is that the set of ideas that they embrace are actually quite mainstream. Even if their vision of a collapse of civilization is still on the fringe, their critique of civilization, of the conceptions of progress, the critique of technology, their critique of science, and a sort of broader back to the land sort of perspective that's not fringe in any way. That's, Naomi Klein and Bill McKibben and, even Prince Charles, there's a anti-modernist critique that runs straight through right into the mainstream of contemporary discourse. If anything, people like, ITS or Derek Jensen, Deep Green Resistance, these sorts of figures and groups are merely taking these ideas to their logical conclusion.
Yeah, okay. So that's how I kind of felt about the Unabomber, mm-hmm. was that if I believed that, we should try to return to some sort of state of nature or something closer to being in balance with nature, and that we needed to deindustrialize a bit, maybe I wasn't going to be like as radical as Cerzan or Jensen and say we need to get rid of all technology. But if I believed that that was the right direction, then all I was arguing with would be tactics.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
And I wasn't absolutely a pacifist, so it was hard for me to argue. But I didn't, in the end, I developed, pretty quickly my own critique. But I just want to say I was not a complete moron back then. But it was easy if you started to accept what was then pretty common coin on the left, especially in Portland, some of these ideas from Cerzan and Jensen, it was easy to be confused, I think.
And the first premise is that industrial civilization is not, and civilization itself, but especially industrial civilization, is not and can never be sustainable. Civilization is not and can never be sustainable. Before we go any further, it's like, okay, that's nice. What's civilization? And, I've been bashing civilization for about 15 years now, and so I figure I'd probably better finally define it. And the definition that I'm using is that civilization is a way of life that's characterized by the growth of cities. And that's defensible both linguistically and historically. Well, that's nice, Derek, but what's a city? And a city, I've defined as a collection of people living in numbers large enough to require the importation of resources. And what that means is the Talua, on whose land I now live, were not civilized. They didn't require the importation of resources. They didn't live in cities. They lived in villages, camps. And once again, they didn't require the importation of resources. They would eat salmon and clams and huckleberry and salal and salmon salmon, and then usually through the winter they would eat a lot of salmon. And the tile lived there for 12,500 years, if you believe the myths of science, and if you believe the myths of the tile, then the evolution has been very long.
How true is it that Naomi Klein's perspective and Derek Jensen's perspective are really in line with each other? I mean, where do they differ?
There are differences. And one has to be clear that this is a spectrum of thought that I am taking on, rather than I'm certainly not saying that Naomi Klein is identical to Derek Jensen, is identical to ITS or...
Right. No, of course not. But I mean, but again, beyond tactics, I mean, beyond what they'll accept tactically, and what do you think their differences are ideologically?
I think mainly the difference between them is which sort of epoch in history or prehistory do these people prefer that we should go back to? They all agree that modern life is rubbish, but Naomi Klein, in her book, at one point favors the 1970s. She thinks that we just all need to retreat back to the 1970s. And then at another point in her book, she sort of says, well, actually, we should retreat back to, or not so much retreat, but that the problem is industrial society. And then at another point, she says that the fundamental problem actually is Judeo-Christian civilization. So, I mean, I saw a meme the other day from a friend of mine who's more into this sort of thing, and on Facebook, and he said something along the lines of that, you know, your grandmother knew how to deal with the Depression because everything was locally sourced and she knew how to do stuff. So that is, maybe it's a sort of Depression era level of technology in advance. Then you have people like Paul Kingsnorth in the UK, who is a sort of British version of Derek Jensen, but much more literary minded, let's say. He's actually a beautiful, beautiful writer, although I disagree fundamentally with pretty much everything he says. His favorite epoch is sort of pre-English Civil War. So, you know, 16th century sort of period. And then you have Derek Jensen, who feels that just, you know, civilization, agriculture was where humanity fell, and he sort of wants to retreat back to that. And you get, you know, then John Zerzan, even sort of symbolic thought is problematic, and then you get into real difficulty there, because you have to begin to go back if you're really consistent with this perspective. You actually have to go back further than the emergence of Homo sapiens there. So,
far out in the uncharted backwaters of the unfashionable end of the western spiral arm of the galaxy lies a small, unregarded yellow sun. Orbiting this at a distance of roughly 98 million miles is an utterly insignificant little blue-green planet whose ape-descended life forms are so amazingly primitive that they still think digital watches are a pretty neat idea. This planet has, or rather had, a problem, which was this. Most of the people living on it were unhappy for pretty much of the time. Many solutions were suggested for this problem, but most of these were largely concerned with the movements of small green pieces of paper, which is odd, because on the whole it wasn't the small green pieces of paper that were unhappy. And so the problem remained. Lots of the people were mean, and most of them were miserable, even the ones with digital watches. Many were increasingly of the opinion that they'd all made a big mistake in coming down from the trees in the first place. And some said that even the trees had been a bad move, and that no one should ever have left the oceans.
Although Douglas Adams obviously was a great perfect example of somebody who was absolutely able to appreciate nature, or rather the rest of nature, be concerned about what was happening, and at the same time was a great Enlightenment thinker.
He was kidding. It was a dark joke for when Douglas Adams said it, but not this guy. Zerzan is serious. It's really only a matter of how far back in time people are willing to think, that makes some difference. So that means that none of these people, just to be technical about it, are progressive.
No, absolutely. Once upon a time, the idea that utopia lay in the past, that time was the things were better in the past. That was historically the conservative perspective, that we need to go back to some previous period. Whether we're talking about contemporary conservatives who, things were better in the 50s or when, men were men, and or a sort of Catholic reaction, counter-enlightenment, Burkean reaction to the French Revolution, that thread that runs through all of conservative thought is that something was life was better at some point in the past. Liberal thought basically has, if we can continue the metaphor here, liberal thought was right now is great, and the socialist, the progressive perspective was that we held utopia to be in the future somewhere, that we were the future oriented category, and conservatives were the people who looked to the past. We somehow, in my final chapter, I tentatively put forward a hypothesis as to why this has happened and when this began to happen, that the left began to retreat from, or at least large sections of the left retreated from, this perspective of a future-oriented progressive vision into a sort of neo-reaction, dressed up in a sort of green language. I feel that it's ultimately a product of neoliberalism itself, that once Thatcher, Reagan, neoliberalism in general foreclosed the future, that there is no alternative, that after the world historic defeat of the working class in the late 1970s and early 80s, that the future was canceled in Mark Fisher's term, that now the only place, the only location where we can find our utopias are in the past. So in order to overcome neoliberalism, we have to revive this idea of a future-oriented progressive vision. But at the same time, in order to get that future-oriented progressive vision, we have to overcome neoliberalism, if you see what I mean.
But the Back to the Land movement goes back to the 60s. That's before the neoliberalism.
For sure, but you can actually trace it much further back than that. You can, and in the book, I look to the origins on the far right of the organic movement.
Yeah, but I mean, as a left movement.
As a left movement, absolutely. If you go back and you read articles in the New Left Review or other progressive journals at this time, there's a great sort of skepticism around the emerging environmental movement, where traditional socialist trade unionists were saying, well, you know, we're down with this whole sort of anti-pollution stuff because that's affecting our communities. But this whole, you got to protect everything, no matter what, that's they were used to sort of high Tories making these arguments and were quite skeptical of that. Having said that, at the same time, you know, you can go back, as I write in my book, you can, there is a, there's also a moment at the end of the Second World War where, you know, with Adorno and Horkheimer and the dialectic of Enlightenment, where they are, you know, quite understandably, absolutely horrified at the you know, industrial Holocaust and the how science at its, you know, zenith is used to, the bomb bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Understandably, there's this great horror.
Yeah.
At modernity, but it's a mistake. It's fundamentally a mistake.
But I think that moment of the bombing of Hiroshima might be a better moment to look to as to when we started to want to back away from, I mean, probably even before then, but certainly then we wanted to back away from technology, back away from science as something that was always, you know, that was going to solve our problems. And at the same time, really back away from the Enlightenment and from reason as well.
In my book, I try to trace sort of a loose out, sort of timeline of the development of these ideas. And I do go back through Adorno, Horkheimer, and further back. And even, you know, you can even go back to, there's always been a sort of tension on the left between a sort of scientific vision, a rationalist vision, and a more romantic perspective. But what I would say is that I think that even the Adorno and Horkheimer sort of perspective was not in any way dominant on the left. What was in the post-war period? What was dominant on the left in the post-war period was absolutely, it was still like the broader left. You know, the millions of people who belong to trade unions or left parties or communist parties, social democratic mm-hmm. parties, for Trotskyist organizations and so on and so forth. Absolutely, these were productivist or visions. They're future-oriented visions. It was really, I think, only in the sort of neoliberal era that the back to the land, anti-modernist perspective began to really, really take on a much wider wider perspective. Today, anywhere, London, Portland, Victoria, where I live, Toronto, and you know, any city in Europe, you will come across a deeply entrenched anti-modernist perspective of, you know, of various different flavors, and there's all sorts of contradictions there. Obviously, Prince Charles's anti-modernism is different from the Pope's anti-modernism, which is different from Derek Jensen's or whatever. But it's very, very broad. It's not a fringe perspective at all. Whereas I think in the 1960s and 1950s, if you went into a, you know, a trade union hall and you spouted these ideas about localism or whatever, you would be laughed out of the room.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, localism is particularly bourgeois notion of solution. Well, let's go through a couple of your pretty substantial critiques of these ideas, more than just kind of bashing them and tracking them down to where they came from. With Naomi Klein, what do you think? She just recently had a book about climate change that came out.
Yeah.
What are the solutions that she offers there, and what is your major critique of say that book?
She's enormously contradictory. On the one hand, she is grasping towards some of the correct solutions as far as I'm concerned, which is a revival of public sector infrastructure. Unfortunately, she simultaneously picks and chooses which sort of infrastructure she's in favor of. So she's all for local transportation, and she's for solar and wind energy. But even there, she's a little bit, she's not so public sector on that. She's more in favor of feed-in tariffs, which are fundamentally a neoliberal and private sector option. And she categorically, you know, denounces nuclear energy and large-scale hydroelectric. The problem with focusing on solar, and I mean, there's so many different problems here, but basically the sun doesn't always shine and the wind doesn't always blow. And so we need some what's called non-intermittent baseload provision of clean electricity. And for that, we basically have two, maybe three options. We have nuclear power, we have large-scale hydroelectric, it's always on, and geothermal. With the latter two, hydroelectric and geothermal, you have to basically have the luck of living in an area where the geography is permits that. So British Columbia, where I live, we have rich bounty of hydroelectric. 96% of our energy, our electricity here is hydroelectric. It's perfectly clean because British Columbia is very mountainous. The Canadian prairies is completely flat, and so there is no way that hydroelectric is going to be an option there. Unsurprisingly, they're very dependent on coal.
Yeah,
geothermal is great in Iceland, and in the northeast of British Columbia, but there are other areas of the world where that's just simply not going to happen. So really, we're looking at nuclear power as one of the main solutions internationally. That's not to say we shouldn't do solar and wind, and certainly those areas where wind is, luxuriantly available, like the Denmark and even off the coast of British Columbia. Those certainly are options in addition to baseload power. But solar in northern climes in Germany and British Columbia and Canada, it's a non-starter because it's just too cloudy. In Ontario, the feed-in tariffs that Naomi Klein celebrates have produced less than 1% of the electricity generation in that province. It's a complete boondoggle. Fundamentally, feed-in tariffs are basically the way that they work. Everybody has to pay an increased electricity fee. The increased revenues that are delivered from that tariff then are paid to usually private entities to develop solar or wind. So everybody, including poor people, pay this increased tariff. So it's a flat tax, basically. It's not progressive. But poor people, renters, and so on and so forth, have no capacity to invest in solar panels or wind turbines on their roof. Homeowners do. And so it's a transmission belt, a redistribution of wealth from poor to the middle class. It's an utter disaster. So these are the sort of frustrations that I have with Naomi Klein, where while she says that she's in favor of public sector infrastructure to as part of the solution, she's still trapped in this smallest beautiful mindset. She describes hydroelectric and nuclear as a perfect example of human hubris. We are thinking too big and we need to retreat back to the small. It's quite the opposite. Quite the opposite.
The problem there with the wind turbines and the solar panels isn't so much that it's unfair to the poor, although it might be. It's also that it just won't be very widespread. It just won't take off because not very everyone can afford it, right?
Oh, well, for sure. One absolutely could imagine a situation where instead of using the neoliberal mechanism of feed-in tariffs, that just a public sector energy utility just went and built these.
Do you think those kinds of solutions, house by house like that, could have a dramatic impact on the energy consumption and pollution?
It depends what we're talking about, where we're talking about it. No matter where we're talking on the planet, even in the Sahara, night comes once a day. So even in the Sahara, solar will not work at night. There's a lot of greens who will say, all we have to do is we have to put lots of research into new forms of batteries so that we can store it overnight. And that's, I'm not opposed to it. I think that's absolutely, we definitely need to put more resources into the basic and applied research in these areas. But we should also remember that the amount of energy that it takes to produce a battery is significant. And there are carbon emissions associated with that as well. So we have to look at the full life cycle analysis of how many carbon emissions are produced by developing these batteries. And when we do that, we find that actually the cleanest, simplest, most energy efficient battery is just pumping water into a dam and then basically releasing it back down, pumped hydro storage, which is it's another form of hydroelectric effectively. And again, you are restricted by geography there. So there's an upper limit of where you can do that. There was a fellow recently I'd seen who'd done a sort of back of the envelope calculation of how many new dams would have to be created in the United States in order to build sufficient these very, very simple forms of batteries in order to maintain modern society, but without any further growth, any further expansion, just to maintain the current sort of levels of energy consumption in the United States. And it was ridiculous. I can't remember exactly what the figure was, but you'd have to build another order of magnitude of dams than already exist in the United States.
So you're saying, what I'm hearing you saying is that really you need to keep nuclear on the table.
Absolutely. And the three main objections that the Greens have to nuclear were either never real problems, they were exaggerated, or they now basically the state of the technology today is such that they're no longer an issue. It's basically, you know, the complaints about nuclear power are like, if you know, basically you might as well be complaining about how VHS sucks because you have to constantly fast forward and rewind. Well, in 2050, nobody uses VHS cassettes anymore.
But after Fukushima, how can you talk about nuclear power? We're still dealing with crabs,
yeah,
with crabs with, you know, two heads and all sorts of irradiated fish. It drives my son crazy because we have friends who will talk about how they can't eat seafood and all the fish and in the ocean are now polluted, you know, irradiated because of Fukushima, and they're reading, I don't know, natural news or something. And there really is a belief in certain parts of the Pacific Northwest that was devastating beyond belief, and that we're all still at risk for every cancer because of that. So how bad was that really? And what about concerns about on the scale of Fukushima?
Inform you about the greatest cataclysm, catastrophe, calamity in recorded history. I kid you not, and that is Fukushima Daiichi and the death of the entire North Pacific Ocean and the beginning of the death of the West Coast.
Intolerant is the hottest eating trend in the New Age community since we found out you don't have to eat animals.
Nuclear war 1,000 years ago blasts the planet apart into the billions of pieces that form the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter. Despite massive genetic damage, an elite core of Quetzals managed to escape in their disc-shaped spacecraft to Earth.
Of course I'm going. founding editor of Natural News, just published this bombshell: China and America already at war. Tianjin explosion carried out by Pentagon space weapon in retaliation for yuan currency devaluation.
Goodwill to men. Goodwill to men.
What are men, Grandpa? Yeah, Grandpa, what are men?
Eh? Huh? What's that? Oh, yes, men. Well, there ain't no men in the world no more, sonnies. No more men. But as I remember the critters, they was, they was like monsters.
Fukushima Daiichi and the death of the entire North Pacific Ocean.
It's really sad to see so many progressive people here on the West Coast. I mean, it's, for me, it's such a, it's such an example of how far progressives have moved from traditional Enlightenment skeptical habits of mind. You know, a few months ago, people were sharing on Facebook. There was this sort of map supposedly showing across these waves of radiation moving across the Pacific. And look, it's, you know, within days it'll hit British Columbia and Oregon and Washington State. You just had to click on the photograph and see that this was a map of the tsunami itself. Not the not sort of waves of radiation hitting the US. I mean, it's really, really sad that people aren't doing their due diligence in terms of looking into this stuff. The reality is that not a single person has died as a result of Fukushima. 10,000 people died as a result of the tsunami itself, and I to some extent I would say I think it's quite sickening that people are banging on about imagined deaths from Fukushima, when actually there were 10,000 real deaths from a tsunami, and that people don't seem to have any sort of sympathy for them.
Dramatic, but not